Stu is driving up right now in Ramat Beit Shemesh. It'll take a minute. It's always good to introduce people when you're not in front of them, because then you don't have to feel that you're embarrassing them. Just one quick story. Before you go to Har Herzl tomorrow, you might have heard, everybody might have heard this story, but it's worth relaying it on Yom HaZikaron. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Everybody familiar with the name of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach? He was one of the biggest Gdolei Hador, passed away, I believe, 1994. One of the biggest Gdolei Hador, but he was not stuck to any camp, Haredi, Tzioni. Everyone had respect for him, and everyone considered them the Rebbe's, from Yeshivat Hezers to he was a Rosh Yeshiva of a more black hat Yeshiva. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach was a Rebbe in Kol Torah, which is a Yeshiva in Bayit Vegan. Bayit Vegan, the street where the yeshiva was, Hapiska, is right across the street from Har Herzl, right across the street. So there was once Talmidim that went up to Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. It was during the summer. They get a little antsy, and they felt that there were a lot of people that were sick and that people needed people to daven for, and they decided they wanted to go up to the north. They wanted to go up north to Meiron, to Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, to Rav Akiva, and to daven by the Kibbutz Tzaddikim. They were nervous because they didn't want to leave yeshiva for the day. Right? Certain people are nervous to leave yeshiva for a day. They were a little bit nervous they should leave yeshiva for the day. They, you know, is it worth it? Should we do it? We want to daven. It's important for us to get out a little bit. But they asked Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, and they said, we really want to daven. We have a lot of people who are sick, and it would be good for us, you know, to go up and daven by these places. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach answered. He said, I don't understand. Why do you have to take so much time to go up to the north and daven? That's where, you know, all the tzaddikim are buried up north. That's where we want to daven. So Shlomo Zalman Orbach said, I don't understand. Go right across the street. And they said, what's right across the street? Who's buried right across the street? He said, Har Herzl, all the soldiers. You want to daven in front of tzaddikim? You want to daven for people to get better, to get refuah shleima? You want to daven for people to get married and people to have children? Well, the greatest place to daven is right across the street in Har Herzl, because those soldiers are considered kivrei tzaddikim. So tomorrow at Har Herzl, not only going to learn about the people, but you can even say tefillas based on Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. It's kivrei tzaddikim, so you can take tefillas. Okay, yes, keep on going. A little introduction about Stuart Schrader. He's in the book of Psalm Genin. Actually, it's very interesting that he basically grew up in a modern Orthodox background, like a lot of us here. He went to yeshiva for the year, he was inspired. I think he went back to America and decided he's going to come back for the army. And I think it's very appropriate that we're having somebody, he's not, you know, he wasn't born in Israel, and he's exactly the lives that we've been, basically, more or less, that we've been living. And that says something very special, the fact that based on certain decisions in life, he found himself fighting Farm Yisrael and Jenin, which was such a difficult battle. I know that I realize I keep on talking about Chomat Magen, defensive shield, Jenin, Shechem. That was probably, you guys were 10 years old during that time, right? 11 years old. So I took it. Yes. Yeah? Older. You guys were even bar mitzvah. I take it. It seems so short ago, but. But it was a very, very difficult battle. I'm sure Stu will touch upon it, the difficult battle, how many people died. And tomorrow we're going to be by Kivrei Tzaddikim who are dead, soldiers who died. Tonight we hear a soldier who lived through it, and that's also something that we have to respect. The name is the people who lived and saw all their unit die, a lot of their unit, a lot of friends. That's the story of Am Yisrael in every war, and it continues. And I'm not going to continue. We'll wait for Stu, who's in the building.
Sorry I'm late. I actually just came back. I was lucky enough to be in Akko today. I looked at my odometer, and it's 370 kilometers round trip, if you guys are curious. My name is Stuart Schrader. I made Aliyah to Israel about 17 and a half years ago. I am a graduate of the Ramaz High School. See, at least we have one other Ramaz graduate in the room right now. I then went to Brandeis University after spending a year at Yeshivat Keren Biavne. And then after I finished Keren Biavne, I graduated in May of 1990. Am I going to make May of 1990? Wait a second. You guys are... Right? You're born in 89, right? Oh, God. Okay. In May of 1990, I graduated college, and in September of that same year, I came to Israel and with my backpack on my back, and I ended up staying in Israel for the next 17 or 18 years. After approximately 11 months here, I got myself drafted into the army. After I studied at the Shivat HaMiftar for a little while, then I went to Shivat Or Etzion, Rav Drukman's yeshiva, he's been in the news lately. And those conversions that he talks about, I'm going to open up parentheses here, I actually used to participate in weddings that he used to hold at his house for those people that he converted. It was amazing, it was a beautiful thing. I went into the army in July of 1991. I'll tell you one story about my first day in the army. They're calling everyone in the room, and sure enough, we get there, we don't know anything. Really don't know anything. Some of the guys don't speak Hebrew. We come into this room, and the sergeant in the room, in charge of this room, is explaining to us basically how to get dressed. How to put your boot on, how to put your shirt on, how to put your pants on. And we had these glow-in-the-dark strips that, at the time, all female soldiers were required to wear on their bags. And all the male soldiers did nothing with it, except for the 3 days that you were at the Bakum, which is the main processing station. And he told us, like, to take this strip out, it was Velcro, put it on your belt loop, and close it. That was the whole explanation. So, of course, someone said, can you do it in English? So someone translated it into English. Of the 22 people in the room, we ended up 14 different languages. 14 different languages, 22 people in the room. Now, some guys knew two or three, but I think then, that was my first day in the army, and then I realized that, oh, this is something very special. After 2,000 years, this is the army of the Jewish people. The Jewish people came from everywhere, came together in one place. Now we're in the army again. I became a tank commander in the army. That's the guy who stands up. Actually, tanks are built for people my size, you can see. That wasn't good enough for me. I first started as a gunner. I sat inside a tank and keep my eye out like that. And that was what we first learned to do. And then I was chosen to go into a tank commander course, became a tank commander in the Army, and as a reservist, I serve as a tank commander in the Army. So remember, this is in the early 90s. At the time, there wasn't a lot of tank warfare occurring in Israel. So we were like every other soldier. We were stationed in a number of different refugee camps and in the refugee camp called the Hesha, which is right across the street from, right down the road from Bethlehem, in Bethlehem. The First Intifada was different than this current period of unrest. First Intifada, we were actually able to walk around in the daylight and at nighttime, and the only orders we had to wear our helmets on our vests rather than wear them on our heads, or nowadays you can't walk around there at all. That was the First Intifada, and life has changed slightly. I've done reserve duty along the way, a number of different places. My first reserve duty ever, I was at the Erez Junction 3 weeks after I got married. I pointed that out to the. The first one was an exercise of drills with the tanks. I pointed that out to the commanding officer, and he said, "Okay, that's nice. Mazel. Now go sleep over there." We've done reserve duty all around the country, along the borders. Now I'm going to take you back about 6 or 7 years. March, April of that year, 2001, if I'm getting the dates right, 2002, right, 2002. March, April 2002. The month of March or April was the bloodiest month for Israelis that anyone could remember. I was here, actually, in the mid-90s. There were a couple of weeks where, those of you who remember, those of you who were here at the time, the number 18 bus, if you remember that, number 18 bus, if you remember, blew up twice. One time in one part of the city, one time in another part of the city. And unfortunately, a lot of people were killed that those days. But this month, in March or April 2002, I think the number is over 130. Over 130 people were killed in that month. And that score is wounded. The night of Pesach, and I say the night in Israel, the night of Pesach, of course we were here in Beit Shemesh, didn't know really what was going on. Only later in the day, I remember on the second, on Yom Tov, on the Chag itself, I remember someone had started hearing bits and pieces. You know, in America it was like bits and pieces, did the Yankees win? Now here it was a little different. We heard bits and pieces that there was something happened in Netanya the night before. Take it back, the night before a bomber, suicide bomber, homicide bomber, went into the Park Hotel in Netanya while people were eating the Seder. Walked into the middle of the floor, blew himself up in the middle of the Seder. Over 30 people were killed that night, and it all come to a degree that the Israeli government army said, that's enough. The next day, it's a Friday, which is, in America, was still Chag, second day of Yom. My family and I used to go away once in a while. My mother used to comes to visit on Pesach usually. And we usually used to go away for that weekend, for the Shabbat, Chol Hamoed. And so that day, that Friday, we were all planning to go up to the north, to Tiberia, Tiberias, and so along the way, we were going to meet my aunt. She lives in, I don't say aunt anymore, I don't know why, but on the way up, my mother's sister. We were supposed to meet her, Natanya, to go out to eat with her, and I get a phone call before I leave from my mempe, my faket pluga, which means the company commander. Now, trust me, before I came to the army, I didn't know how to say the things in English. I only know how to say most of the things in Hebrew. It took me a long time to learn how to say them in English. So if I get something wrong, you can ask me a question. And really, stop me along the way. If you have any questions, please. That day, I get a call from my company commander, and he says, "Ma shalom, how you doing? Chag Sameach, Chag Sameach. Makovei, what's going on?" Well, like all good things in the army, he wasn't really sure. So he then says, just in case, we got a call, there may be something cooking. As in, and I, now trying to understand this a little better. I am a veteran immigrant now. At the time, I was a veteran immigrant also. We did not live through those. Me, I did not live through the Six-Day War, the Yom Kippur War, the Lebanon War, where men were called out of their homes to go up a general call up and go there. That experience, thank God, I was saved from that experience. So didn't quite know. I said, okay, fine, you know, they'll call us up. We'll get ready to go. You know, like the Boy Scouts, we're prepared, sort of. I had this bag, this big ugly green bag that has all stuff in it, but in the end, you can pull out your underwear. You got to. So I actually put it in the car with me. That, without knowing, I said, "Well, we're going up to Tiberias. We're leaving the house for a couple of days. Maybe, who knows?" So the whole day, I'm trying to coordinate with my friends who are also going to this place for the weekend. That just in case that I need to go somewhere, can they meet us and take my family the rest of the way? So I'm waiting for the call. Of course, the call doesn't come. Then later in the day, I said, "You know, Judy, this doesn't make sense. I got a call." I call up while we're on the way to Tiberias, and he says, "Yeah, come on down. We were called up." So I went to Tiberias, dropped the family off. and said goodbye. Now, I'm somewhat flippant about this, but as it turns out, and I only realized this a month after everything, how quite difficult this was on the family. My mother was there. You raise your son to be a cowboy or something like that, but sure enough, she watches her son, her only son, her youngest child, go off to war, literally. That she had no idea. We all had no idea. I was pretty laid back about it. Oh, well, you know, don't worry, we'll go. I'm not allowed to ask. Sort of like Wisconsin, Czechoslovakia, like Wisconsin, we zip in, we zip out. Thank you. That's what it was like. Yeah, we'll go. We'll do what we gotta do. We'll go. We'll finish. No problem. No big deal. It's all time. So this is Friday. I start driving, coming to Erev Shabbos. I call up a friend of mine. I'm gonna pick him up. He's at the kibbutznik. I see him hugging his wife. She's bawling. Oh, wow. I start thinking a little differently about this. Now I had a halakha question. So I know pretty much that, listen, if you have to drive, you have to drive. It's okay. So I called up, Rav David, those of you who may know who he is, there's over there, Rav Barshul. And I don't know if I really had a specific question, but I sort of wanted to hear what he had to say. I didn't even know which way to go with this. So he gave me actually pretty good advice. This was, I think, very clever. He said, use as much of the 20 minutes as you can, and take Shabbos in as late as possible. Accept Shabbos in as late as possible. That was a clever little idea. To minimize as much as you can. You minimize as much Chil Shabbos as you can. But he said, no, go, you gotta do what you have to do, drive around, doesn't matter. So you have to turn the radio off. I get down to our base Friday night. There's an entire range. We have this whole process of becoming a soldier. Our tanks are in canvas bags. These big things. Nowadays they've changed. It's new. I recently went to see where the tanks are now. It's different. They were in these big bags. You had to unzip them. I'm not kidding. Unzip them. With boards and the drill. Alright. So we have this whole thing. You have to get your equipment there, especially there's certain equipment that the tanks need. So you have to wait in line here, wait in line there, and there's a clerk here, and a clerk there, and a clerk there, and a clerk there. One thing we always used to joke about. That they always used to say to us, and you have to get the box of crackers. Now, you have to have food. And we don't know where your next meal's coming from, so you have the rations, the food rations. And they always used to say to us, and here you'll get the crackers. It was a joke, it was a running joke. This tin can, familiar with this? This tin can of dry, disgusting crackers. What day is it? Shabbat Chol Moed? Pesach. Chomei's gone. So I'm not taking it. Can't take it. Say, no, you gotta take it. I can't take it. You gotta take it. See what I'm tanks. I don't even know where they are to this day. Never ate those things. They were in disgust. That was really dangerous. On that day, on Shabbat, so we have to get ready. We have to prepare the tanks. We have to load them up with the machine guns, load them up with. Actually, they're not allowed to be loaded with. Yes, we did. We loaded them up with shells, cannon shells, and we had to go to a riflery range, to a shooting range, to coordinate our weapons, our own weapons. We rode on Shabbat on a bus. I'm blessed to have a unit with a number of datiyim in this unit, including at least one guy who's dayan, at least one guy who was a ram in yeshiva and shadmot mechola. So Baruch Hashem, we have some talmidei chachamim there, and we were all on the bus, riding the bus on Shabbat towards the end of the day. But it was clear to everyone. We had a job to do, and the joke that we say is that God's going to forgive me for the Chilul Shabbat that we did there, but for the loof, the what we would call spam in America, the canned meat that we had no choice but to eat because that was the only food we had, it was kosher Pesach, he's going to get me for that one. That stuff is cool. That's nice. But we ate that, and that's what we had to do. So now this is ready. Shabbat. We finished preparing the tanks. Sunday, we get our orders. I ride up with the Mempe to, we're supposed to coordinate with an infantry unit. They tell us we're going to Jenin.
Okay. Jenin. Huh.
We don't know what that means. It means that we're going to go in, take Jenin.
Okay.
Now, our training in the tanks, we were trained to fight Syria and Jordan and Egypt. But we have peace with Egypt. We don't fight them. In Jordan, we now have peace. We don't fight them either. But we were trained. Now, just picture you on your TLM, I'm sure you've seen this, around the country, what the Golan Heights looks like. Big, spread out land, everything, there's room to move, room to maneuver. Now imagine taking one of these big, hulking pieces of metal and running down the streets of Beit Shemesh. Now the streets of Beit Shemesh, you may not believe this, are actually wider, as it turns out, than the streets of Jenin. And the streets of the refugee camp in Jenin are even smaller and narrower than that. So we had no idea. There was, at the time, there were some soldiers, there were some tanks who had gone in, like they're doing now, gone into different places in the territories, like into Shechem. We were told and we received a briefing on what we had to do with these tanks. Close all the hatches. Understand that in a second. Tie down and secure all the guns. Now the tank has two machine guns on top. Another machine gun parallel to the cannon. Right? Another machine gun parallel to the cannon. And it has, in my tank, we have a hatch for where the commander stands, it's the right side, and a hatch where the gunner stands. Inside, the loader stands here, the gunner sits here in front, and the driver sits all the way in front in his big, roomy living room. He actually has the most room there. So there's three guys inside the turret, one guy inside the driver's area, and that's four members of a tank. Now we had to prepare these tanks, and we were told that you have to tie down the guns, tie down the machine guns. Why?
Someone steal.
Right. So then when they climb on the tank, they don't take them away. Now, when they're climbing on a tank, probably the least you're worried is them taking your gun. So you had to close the hatches and secure the hatches closed also. That was another thing there. Now, so we were going in, as it turns out, we were in the refugee camp of Jenin, there was one company of tanks, and it was a reserve company, that was my company of tanks. A company of tanks is 11 tanks, of which only 9 fought. Two were left, we left just in case we would need them for extras. Now, they prepare us for these things. They tell us that, yeah, you have to watch out. It seems that in this place where you're going, they don't have an RPG, rock and pill grenades, that can do damage. You guys are lucky. They don't have anti-tank weapons yet, as far as we know. Thank you very much. But you have to stay inside the tanks, everything closed. Now, that's, as I said, I'm built for a tank. Not everyone is. We receive our orders that we're going to coordinate with an infantry unit, a reserve infantry unit, who is responsible to take the refugee camp. Now, we really don't know exactly what's going on. All we know is that we're going to go in there, we'll be the long-range fire cover, we'll be able to spot if anyone needs any help, the infantrymen who are going in, they need help from us, we'll be able to give it from afar. That's what we're good for. The night of, we finish our training, we come down here now, as it turns out, we really didn't know what was going on. Which is, it's normal, par for the course. And to be expected. It's during Pesach, and I have my tefillin with me. We had to come down here to Beit Guvrin, not farther down the road here, to do some training. I called up home, got them to bring me my tefillin for after Pesach, because we had no idea when we would see anyone again. And they brought me a jar of gefilte fish.
jar of gefilte fish. That was kesef.
Now the jar of gefilte fish came in handy. Because we get our orders that we're going to attack the last night of Pesach. The jar of gefilte fish, as my stepfather calls those pieces, he calls them museum pieces. Those have been in the jar. We don't know how long they've been in the jar. I have to love them. So we receive our orders that night, the night of the last night of Pesach. The entire fighting force that is going into Jenin is masked right inside a place called Jalameh. And we're waiting for our orders to move. And we're going to go in that night. Most people read the book?
No.
Good, it's okay. You don't have to. You can skip the parts about me, but read the parts about Gadi Ezra and those guys. Those are important. There's a tefillah that you say before you go into battle. That night, first we had without Mar, we had no lights, couldn't turn lights on, right? Because A, we have to be in the dark, and B, can't turn light on to read a sitter on Yom Tov. So I was able to, we had daven out loud. Some people, not everyone knew the tefillah. We were able to say tefillah out loud so people could daven along with us. Even Shmona Esrei, Sa'an Shmona Esrei, Yom Tov Shmona Esrei. Then we had a festive Yom Tov meal with a gefilte fish and matzah. So the gefilte fish came very handy. That was our Yom Tov meal. We had Kiddush. And then we went back to our tanks and received our orders. And one of the commanders of the tank, and at this point I was serving as a loader in a tank, because I had to fill in a place, didn't have enough people, so I went in as the loader of a tank. It was actually a very experienced unit, a very experienced group of guys, one of our commanders asked permission from the company commander to over the radio to say the tefillah before going into battle. So if you look in your sidurim, you'll find it. It's a beautiful tefillah, very moving. You hear a song that God should watch over us. And per tank, everyone said amen. Each tank, one at a time. On the kesher, on the radio, each one said amen. Then we move out. 2 in the morning, we get there. Nothing. Get the place where we are. Very quiet. Very simple. Nothing's happening. Okay. Time goes on. The day starts rising, and we start hearing gunshots. Within the first hour, the first person to get killed is a Golani Mempe, a Golani company commander. I just saw they brought out a book about him. With our tanks right near there, we didn't know they were firing at us. We were stationed on top of a hill. 2 tanks there, 3 tanks went that way, 3 tanks went that way. We were surrounding it, and it turns out that we were useless. At that point, we were useless. We couldn't see down. We didn't have any ability to fire and to give any cover. So then they brought the tanks to the other side of the camp. Meanwhile, what has happened? The entire infantry unit, the entire infantry battalion, the Gdud, has surrounded the camp. And on one side of the camp, even the Navy SEALs, the Shayat, the commando, the naval commandos, have taken another side of the camp to prevent anyone from going from the refugee camp into the regular city of Jenin. Now, what is a refugee camp? We have impressions in our head of a refugee camp, those of you who have not been to one. It's not like Camp Hillel or Camp Stemka or whatever those things were. Not like that. Basically what these refugee camps are just, there's no fence around it. In this area there's no fence there. The houses are close to each other. There's a city of Jenin right next to it. There's an area called the Jenin refugee camp. They're cutting off that area. So the place is surrounded. A couple of tanks are on top of the mountain. Some of the tanks are on the other side. So it turns out we get orders that we're not being useful there. They bring us down and they decide, the orders come down, to actually go into the camp, because it turns out that the Palestinians had decided to concentrate their efforts into this, to make almost a customer's last stand kind of thing in this refugee camp. And it turns out that it was truly a nest of terrorist activity. And they had prepared themselves. They prepared themselves, they prepared weapons, they prepared explosives, to the point where we receive orders the next day that we are going to lead the charge into the camp. Our tank is number two. First tank to come to command, our tank is number two. That's important because we're riding about 20 meters, all of a sudden, big explosion. And of course, each one of us is yelling at each other in the tank, what'd you press? What'd you touch? Nothing, shouldn't do anything. Turns out that the company commander, being the nice guy that he was, had run over a roadside bomb and exploded up in our face. As it turns out, thank God, it was reasonably minor, a few kilo, so it didn't really affect it. And then we kept moving. And that was the first case we got that basically the entire place is booby trapped. Really, almost everywhere we went was booby trapped. And that, for us, we found that it didn't really affect us that much, although it was unpleasant. For the infantrymen, that was going to be very serious. We continue to go on, and sure enough, the company commander pulls to the right, the deputy company commander pulls to the left, we go forward, and we are now giving cover for the entire, almost an entire brigade, as it turns out, probably about a few hundred, probably close to 300 or 400 infantrymen, who are now pouring into the camp and fanning out and taking the buildings. And they're getting shot, and then there's gunfire being exchanged. Whereas in one of the stories that we're told there is that a unit of infantry goes up into a building and they're getting fired upon. They ask us to fire onto the building. That they're in the second floor, they ask us to fire on the third floor. Now, there's in code, in army code, the word that we use in the tanks, in the armor corps, is we use the word for the cannon, we use kveda, means heavy, right? Now an infantryman, what is his big weapon? He carries around his rifle, and he also has, some of them have machine guns, big machine guns, bigger machine guns. They, as it turns out, can also refer to that, the machine gun, as a kveda, as kaved, as heavy. So they ask us to fire kaved into the third floor. So we look at each other. Say that again? Kaved. I said, are you sure? We're sure. Are you sure? We're sure. Okay. Take cover. Turn up 105 millimeter cannon from 60 meters. About that. Into the third floor. And then, of course, we actually got pretty nervous. But they got on the radio, don't do that again. Kind of. And so that was, it was a lesson to be learned. Now this is a little lesson. It was good to be in the tank at that time. So sure enough, they're pouring out, and everyone's being fired upon, and we're firing back. Then we come to this understanding with the infantry together. The commanders finally understand how to work it. The goal is that they were going to encircle the camp and really do just tighten the ring. The whole time tighten the ring. Surround on all sides and keep moving in. House to house. Now, understand how dangerous that is for the infantry. So the goal was to have an infantry unit together with a tank or two. The tanks would be stationed here, give them cover, and the infantry would be going through the house. Now, the tank, we were there to sort of make our presence felt. We were somewhat limited in our abilities. We couldn't really move. To the point where, one very important thing. We had said that we will do this, but we must have an infantry unit for our own sake. Remember what we said about the guns. Now the guns are tied up on top. We were worried that people would climb up. We can't see behind us very well. So if at night we were there, and we weren't supposed to be there, but if we were at night we were there, we had an infantry unit watching our tanks. Those are our conditions. Worked out. We had it. Everything was working perfectly. So sure enough, they start pairing us off with the unit. Everyone's working with the unit. We were working at one point with the naval commandos. Two tanks. One tank a little deeper in. One tank was here. We were here, and the naval commandos were going up in the building. Boom, 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 boom. One room after the other. Now, while this is happening, the other tank, my friend's tank, is they lost count after the 20-something bomb that was thrown on them. They said, that's one, two, each time. The guy was coming out of his window throwing bombs on the tank. Now, we had taken out anything that was could have been flammable. That's also, that can be very dangerous. If the tank takes fire, that's bad for the people inside the tank. But at a certain point, he couldn't stay there anymore because it was just too much. So, sure enough, the naval commander said, just wait a second, what's going on? Come out. The next time the guy stuck his head out, that was the last time he stuck his head out. They had removed that threat. And then they went back to work. Very, very, very professional. Very intimidating. They're going through the building, and they did something they weren't supposed to do. They exposed themselves on the roof, and they got ambushed. And they got shot. Two guys got shot at the moment. They went into action. Went upstairs. Put them down. Got on the radio to a helicopter, which is 4 kilometers away. I'm telling you this so you understand the power, what this is like. From about 4 kilometers away, they get on the radio with the helicopter, and they ask the helicopter for a missile into this house. And we were all using the same maps. Each building was numbered. I said, okay, I understand you want us in this. You want us to shoot at this one. Affirmative. I want you to shoot at this one. Then the helicopter pilot said, which window? He said, I want northeast window. He said, I understand northeast window. Northeast window. Are you behind cover? Yes, just shoot already. That's how he yelled. And we were all in the tanks. We were okay. Sure enough, 4 kilometers away, in the window. Then he said, and I'm doing it again. 4 kilometers away, in the window. And then they took the two wounded guys out. Switch was made again. Back to work. Immediately, and they kept going. It was an experience in what the army could well be two different armies out there, the army of the elite units and the army of the rest of us. But it was good to see. So each shift we had inside the camp was 12-18 hours long, wherever it might be. Then one time we actually were lucky enough to spend 37 hours inside the camp. Means overnight inside the hatches. You haven't asked the question that you should all be thinking of. Exactly. Now, that bottle over there is what it was. Now, those bottles were very useful. We had bottles of water with us, and when you finished a bottle of water, right? You couldn't go outside the tank. But when you would finish, when you fill the bottle of water with the other water, we would quickly open the hatch, throw it out, and rather than take it with us. So we were in the tank actually 37 hours at one point. Now at the end of the story, after about 26 or so, the gunner in our tank started feeling a little shaky. He actually had to pull back, and that's not a fun experience. You know, it can be very not easy. The problem was, at night, we were all there sleeping there and trying to sleep in this tank together. And we realized this is the first time, we were the first tank to actually spend the night there. We had tried avoiding it, and we had a unit of Golani soldiers in the building right next to us, and we were right next to the building. And sure enough, every hour, the difference between reservists and standing army, we were very responsible. Every hour, make a check on the radio to make sure everyone's awake and sure everyone's watching you. So for an hour, we were checking with them. They didn't answer for that hour, but it was okay. So we actually kept the decision that we should take the guns inside the tank and not leave them outside the tank. at night because we couldn't see, so we had to climb up. Now remember, we had tied them on really well. So we had to then leave the hatch open again. That was a little nerve-wracking. My friend couldn't do anything, so I do, so I had to climb up there and take it in. We brought it in, the adrenaline rushes there. And now, so we have all three guns inside the tank, all three machine guns inside the tank. And that was actually important because, as it turns out, over the 8 days or so we were there, we fired over 4,000 rounds of ammunition from the main machine gun. At a certain point, the gun stopped firing, so we had to replace that gun. We had the spare guns inside. I mean, that was that mattered a lot. Now, I tell a funny story, and I think that one of my points here this whole evening is about how that was my first point about Israel, the army is the army of the people, and how close to home this really is. At one point, one of the first times we were actually firing in anger, if you will, my cell phone rang. It was my secretary from my office. Now you're all laughing. I answered it. I was thinking, Hinda, I can't talk. But it's true. That's how close to home it was. And that's how, remember, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq are thousands of miles away from the United States. But Jenin, after the 37-hour shift, we came back to our little base there. I slept for a few hours, showered, came home. I was in my house 2 hours later, here in Vichach. I was driving on the highway with three other guys in the car with me. Stuck in a traffic jam in Tel Aviv. And people next to me, you know, they thought we were soldiers, so the people knew what was going on. We didn't know what was going on. We only knew it specifically, but the news was reporting about it. And I said, the people next to us, you know, they're rocking to the tunes, right? They were listening to the songs. And they looked over at us, and so we were all soldiers. Smiled, you know, sort of waved at us, probably understood that we had come from somewhere like that. But it was truly within. I got out of the tank, showered. Why am I even mentioning this even more? Because that morning, during this 37-hour shift, we woke up at 5 in the morning, and the infantry got back to work. And within 4 minutes, they had tripped over a wire, fallen into an ambush, and two soldiers were killed on the spot. One soldier, another one went to help him. A guy named Gadi Ezra, he's in the book of Sam Janine, and also a book came out about him. He also learned at Ordizio, as it turns out. He's a big hulking guy, and they couldn't get him out from the line of fire. Every time they took their head out, the ambush would shoot at them. So the Mempe, the company commander of this unit, special man, who was from Kfar Hasidim, up in the north, He took off his flak jacket, took off his vest, took off his flak jacket, told his deputy, cover me, ran down the hill, it was wet, ran down the hill, put Gadi Ezra, he was 100 kilos, that's over 220 pounds, took him on his back, carried him up the hill to safety. Well, maybe he's already dead, but carried him out. Now, I tell this story because a month later, the battalion, the Gdud 51 of Golani, they were in Tulkarm, and the battalion commander, that's the Magad, the lieutenant colonel, two falafels, he and this Mempe were going into, in the Kasbah in Tulkarm, they were going into storm a room with terrorists behind the door. The Mempe took a knee, the Magad was about to kick the door, a stream of bullets tore out. Now remember, one was bending down, the other one. So the Magad took all the bullets in his legs over here, was seriously wounded. And unfortunately, this Mempe that carried this guy, the Ezra, was killed on the spot. That was a month later. They survived Jenin, and then the unit went there. And he went to this place, and he was originally in the Naval Commandos. That's when he first started in the army. And he decided, he said, when he went to officers, he wanted to train the real army. He chose to go to Golani because he wants to be with them and he wants to try to raise Golani to the heights. Very special man, the family, very special family. One brother was in Sarimakal, very, very special family. And if you can find stuff about this guy, it's important on this note. So that morning, so we were in this battle as a tank, and we felt horribly helpless. Because we said, guys, just tell us where to shoot. We will bring down hell from heaven. We will do whatever you need. And sure enough, the two kids were killed right in front of us. And we finished our shift after they had finally gotten them out. We had finished our shift, and now it takes a different meaning when I was in my car 10 hours later driving home to my family. That's how close it is. It's right around the corner. It's right around the corner. One of my friends who I drove home lived 20 minutes from there. Literally 20 minutes from there. He didn't live in one of the yeshivim, like Kadim, which is up in the north part of north of Jenin. They've been what we call, quote unquote, Israel proper. That, I think, is probably the most important lesson we take from all this. I'm a schnook. I live here, I live in Beit Shemesh, I work in Yerushalayim. Pesach, I get a phone call. 5 days later, my secretary's still looking for me. 5 days later, I'm inside a tank in the middle of Jenin, fighting his battle. Now my daughter even asked me, it's such a weird question, she said, Abba, did you kill anyone? I don't want to answer that question. Because I don't think it's anything to be proud of. It's a necessary evil that we have to do. Think about it. When we told you about the first cannon, when we shot over our infantry units, well, the shooting stopped after we shot. And then in other places, the 4,000 rounds of ammunition, we were putting that into buildings, into houses where people shooting at us. These things. My daughter asked me, you know, this is sort of, I fight it. I come from a somewhat liberal background, if you will, you know, the Western liberal tradition. So I sort of fight my own, well, we fight our own tendencies here, but it's not, she asked me to come up or come pick me up in your uniform. I said, no, there's no need to. This is something we do, we're proud to do it. I'm proud. To this day, I'm now old enough that I have to volunteer. Now I volunteer to serve in the Army, to serve in the Tank Corps. I still volunteer, I'm still a tank commander. I'm proud to do this because I'm proud to serve in the Jewish Army for the first time in 2,000 years. I'm proud to defend our state. But it's not something, I'm not a militarist. It's not my dream in the world. I mean, good at it, I may like it sometimes when I'm there. I like crawling around in the mud. I like that. But it's not something to be proud of. So now, give you two more stories, then I'll open it up for questions. So 37 hours, we come back. It was funny when we came back to our little camp. Remember, the place is really tight. Not a lot of place to maneuver. Sure enough, we come back and we finally are able to breathe. We open up the hatch, we're able to breathe, we come out, and everyone who's along the side of the road, all these soldiers looking at us like, they're pointing at us, and then they're like, what's going on? Turned out we took off the sides of the houses, and we took off. You have a sorogim anywhere here? We have like on your house, you know, the bars that keep people out or people in. It turns out we took off half of one, and it was stuck to the tank. We had no idea about this. Now, when we learned about this afterwards, we saw a picture in the newspaper of the other half, still connected to the doorway. Said, "Oh yeah, that we know that one." So really, it looked like we had been through the wars, and we actually had. I know in another tank that I eventually took command of another tank. There was inside the cannon, there's a sleeve that goes around the cannon. It's called a thermal sleeve. And there was at least 6 bullets stuck in it, all about this much. Now, that's either they shot at us, or we shot at ourselves, but I don't think we shot at ourselves where the angle was. So they were shooting at us. And there were little marks on the tank where the paint was chipped off. You don't really notice it, thank God. So sure enough, you come back, shower, it's all fine and dandy now. And I'm thinking now, because I came home that day, it was Yom HaTzmaut. I hung out with my family, my friends, and everyone was sort of, you know, wow, Stu, you know what's going on? No. We had no idea. And there's even more no idea, because if you remember, so you guys were in elementary school, right? Eighth grade or so, right around then? If you remember, they talked about a massacre that we have committed in Geneva, right? So, of course, we had not committed a massacre. But those of us who were there kept asking, well, why didn't you invite us? Because we had no idea that this is what they were talking about, because we were certainly not there. Now, on the human side, this is not an easy thing. After 6 days, where the place is nearly is in rubble, you know, I told you how they were prepared. Let me tell you how the rubble occurred. Eventually, they started knocking down the houses with a big D9. You know, how do you say D9? D9 is a big caterpillar. The big caterpillar steam shovels, right? Big thing, monstrous. You know how to say D9 in Hebrew? D9. So I say D9. Can I put D9? And on the radio, it's known as Doobie, Teddy Bear. That's how it's known. That's its code. Known as Teddy Bear. Now this Teddy Bear doesn't let anything stand in its way. It's actually a pretty awesome machine. So it's going house by house, make sure no one's in there, destroying the house, rather than bombing from above. That's a separate issue. We can talk about that later. It's knocking down the top floor of this house, the second. But in order to knock down the second story, he's got to climb up, right? So he pushes, moves some rubble around from here, from another house, and all of a sudden he's riding along, and I'm telling you, an explosion like you... Inside the tank, we heard this explosion. Boom! Huge explosion. Everyone's looking around at each other. What happened? What did Stefan? What did Stefan? What did Stefan? He says, ah! Aliti al mitan. And I went over a roadside bomb. I said, okay. Ash, 30 kilos. 30 kilos. 30 kilos, guys. 30 kilos. Get rid of your car, no problem. 30 kilos. Corpus said that everything's okay. Corpus said. This guy is Doobie Coolie. That was his nickname, right? Doobie Coolie. 18 hours. Didn't start working. It was unbelievable. Also, Mino Limnik. Reservist. Came to his house. Came there. Did what he had to do. Sat there. Said, guys, you watch me. I'll do my work. I'll do my job. Did his job. 18 hours a day. It was unbelievable. It was astounding. At the end, we saw what the roadside bomb had done to it. It's 30 kilos. Taking one link out of his whole tread. One link. That's all it took. But now, think about what I just said. Where did this rubble come from? It came from another house. There was a 30 kilo bomb in a house. In a house. Didn't just get there. They don't just fall from heaven. They have to be thrown from heaven, as I told you before. They were prepared. Now that mattered. That mattered later when the 13 were killed and that they were. Actually, I was on leave that day. So he's sure enough he's knocking the houses down now. The aftermath of him knocking these houses down is that the houses, one of the things that was bothersome to me, from the human side, where you look inside they have a room with a view, let's put it that way. No windows left and no wall left, but you saw inside the house, people lived there, the furniture half in, half out of the house. No one was living there, but after 6 days at one point, I saw I'd say about 4 to 6 women and about 4 children waving white flag walking out of the rubble. Guys, 6 days in this place. It was the 70 by 70 meters, 70 by 100 meters about, of rubble, of the inside, the inner part of the city. That's where we brought everyone down to. And there were people who had living there. They were living there still during this time. Your heart broke. My heart broke for them. Absolutely. Quite in a horrible situation. No one is blameless. I mean, this is the population, local population. It's not hard to stand up to, it's not easy to stand up to the people who are causing you harm. eventually. The local population did have some sort of tacit, if not a full-blown condemnation of what they did. Perhaps they did condone what was happening. Still, they're people. We sometimes lose sight of that. It's not easy. After they finally finished the big battle, and where they finally they gave up, so we received the task of, we had to monitor the camp, and we had to impose a curfew on the camp. Gave one story of what happened then, sort of trying to give you an impression. We would station a tank at each place in the at the camp. I was at one entrance one time. Canadian press, you know, the foreign press likes haranguing the Israeli soldiers who don't speak English. So they unfortunately couldn't do that. When I stuck my head out, I said, "Oh yeah, where are you from?" So I actually got caught up on some hockey scores, as it turns out, I seem to remember. But we made them pick up their shirts also, which I had no problem doing. Because what had turned out is that there were plenty of people who were escorting the press in with bombs and other explosives smuggled under their shirts. So we made sure that even the reporters would pick up their shirts. The reporter who doesn't want to stop for you does stop when you point the 105mm cannon at. Something you do learn. After a few days there, I was stationed on probably the south side of the camp with two other tanks. They were on the hill being watching me, and I was very close to the camp itself. And I was working together with a infantry unit in a APC. And I see, from my position, I'm able to stand up, see out. We have a little periscope. I'm able to see out, and I notice a woman holding a bundle in her arms coming out of the camp. Now, this is we have a curfew on this camp, and I see the woman coming out, and I said, "I'm pretty sure that's a baby." We have good sight. Tell the gunner to see what she has there. Sure enough, she comes out in the middle. I report. I tell the infantry, "You guys, you have someone coming out. You have to go stop her." They get to her. She gets her. She faints. Face both down on the ground. They then, this infantry, are Sanchanim, a paratrooper unit, they helped this woman get to a house right near there. Came back with a medic. Sanchanim, paratroopers. Came back with a medic. And we were reservists, they were a standing army. We actually said to them, "Guys, don't go into that house. We can't cover you if you're in that house." We couldn't see them. "Don't go into the house." They didn't listen to us, of course. They went into the house. They gave this woman an infusion, IV bed, from their own stock. The woman had given birth 2 days before, 3 days before. She was trying to get to the hospital. We called it up the ranks, asked for the Palestinian ambulance to come. We waited there all day, never came. But the paratroopers that were with us gave this woman an IV so she could recover. Now that was then, a couple days later, we were accused of committing a massacre. And the story actually really happened, if you want to play French, play France. I think these two, what I began with, the story of the 14 languages. The story where I went home in the middle, and sure enough, it was within 2 hours I saw my family. And then this story, it shows how close it is to home for all of us. When you listen to the radio today, I was driving home here to get here on time. Mordechai, I'm sorry. And I was driving here crazy. I was sat in a traffic jam, but at 7:59, I pulled over on the side of the highway by Latrun. And basically, everyone stops, and the siren goes off. And they stand silently there. And it's a sign of solidarity with those who are not here, those who are still here. People who, and here, I slowly am starting to feel part of this. That, and this is, it gives me chills every time it happens. Still, now I'm more and more. The older father I become, the more it gives me chills. And these are people who are part of your life that you may know them, and so
Everyone in Israel knows someone who knows someone. It's part of us. This day of remembrance. On the Jewish side, it's very Jewish of us. The day we're going to celebrate like crazy tomorrow, we always temper it with a slight bit of sadness. You know why today is chosen, the Yom Zikaron? It's the day that Gush Etzion fell. That's why it's here. That was done on purpose. The day that Gush Etzion fell is the day they chose the Yom Zikaron. It's connected to Yom HaTzmaut, connected to the Day of Independence. And this is a lesson for all of us, always, to keep in mind. That, hey, you can be very happy, but just remember that there are people who paved this way. And that is the young man, Gadi Ezra, who was killed. Read the book, if you guys ever read that book. You see, it was a Mamash Tzadik. Mamash. Unbelievable. Sometimes. Hashem. So these are the people that you have to remember. And that's what Yom Zikron is all about. We're part of it. People, individuals, we're part of an entire fabric of a nation. And we all come together to build it together. People came from 14 different countries, came to build it together, came to fight together, came to be here together. And God knows we'll be here for a long time together. Thank you. You're not obligated to ask, but if you have any questions.